Questions?
No, I don't. I never get ready.
Say, for the online assignments, if we do like an extension, I thought we had like, do we have like a week or is it just one day?
So you have one day to ask for an extension.
Okay.
And then I forget how much time you get when you ask for an extension, but I'm pretty sure it's more than a day.
It's totally okay, because I asked for an extension once and it gave me like 50 minutes. But I asked it at like 11:09, so it said you have until 11:50.
Also, as an extension, must be without penalty. Must have been.
It was a really small penalty. Like,
So there's supposedly a 15% penalty for being late, and you have to ask for that within a day that it's due, and I think it's multiple days, like 2 days.
If you asked for it after that day, then you only had the next day to do it, and then it blocks you out.
So I don't think so, but I don't know strongly enough to say that. I think that those are parameters that I could change, and I guess I'll try and remember to go check them.
Okay.
But my intention would be that you would have at least a couple of days in order to work.
I mean, ideally, we wouldn't have to worry about that anyways.
Well, yeah, but I mean, life is complicated. Questions? And incidentally, if you're out of that automatic extension period, if you email me, I would give you an extension beyond.
Okay.
If you were a day late, that would be okay. But I just don't want people doing, you know, the problems on December 18th or something like that.
Right.
So we're talking about energy transfer last time, traditionally talked about as being conduction, convection, and radiation. For conduction, the energy per time that's going to leak through a wall or something like that, we can calculate with this formula. This is the area. The thermal conductivity depends on the material, and you'd have to look that up in your book. And then the temperature difference between the two sides of the material and the thickness of material are the other factors. Every object that has a temperature, which is another way of saying every object, is radiating light, not necessarily visible light, infrared light. And the amount of light that's radiated depends on the temperature to the fourth. The object usually is surrounded by an environment that is also radiating, so it'll be absorbing energy at that rate. So the net loss of energy due to radiation is given by that formula. Convection is a complicated fluid mechanics problem that typically involves turbulence, so we don't have any formulas for that. If you really wanted to know the energy loss due to convection, you'd have to consult the tables in an engineering textbook that basically codify what you would observe experimentally. We found it useful to define this R factor. The R factor that you would get at a Fleet Farm sort of place wouldn't match the R factors that we've got here because they're in these crazy units of like BTUs per hour, per square feet, per degree Fahrenheit or something like that, as opposed to the good God-approved metric units. The kind of reason for using this R factor is we can stack them together and calculate the power output based on the total temperature difference between a whole series of slabs of material. Notice that because the power that goes through this surface has to be the power through that surface, etc., that the thermal conductivity times the slope has to be a constant. So if we have like metal, which is highly conductive, there's going to be a relatively smaller slope than if we have styrofoam, which has a small thermal conductivity. So that's the environment that the object is bathed in. So if the object is in a room, then the walls of that room are going to be at room temperature. If the object is sitting in a furnace, the walls of those furnaces might be at, you know, 1,000 degrees.
So like if they don't give you an external temperature, so you just take it as room temperature?
Well, they have to give you an external temperature. It might be in disguised form, but we need that, right? There's always an environment that has a temperature. I can't think of any problems where they didn't give it to you.
Is there any way, like, have they, like, taken an object, like, out into space space and got it down to like 0 degrees Kelvin?
Well, the temperature of space is 3.7 degrees Kelvin. Okay. So, yep, we are bathed in the light of the Big Bang from all directions, and it looks pretty much exactly like 3.7 degrees above absolute zero. So it should be kind of impossible to have an object in space that is colder than 3.7 degrees above absolute zero, but it has been observed. It takes special stuff, though.
So what would happen to, like, I know we haven't ever done it, but what would happen if something hit absolute zero to the material? Because I asked my ninth grade physics teacher this, and he wouldn't tell me.
So it's, you can...
So, hypothetically, what would happen?
Well, so there's some kind of ifs, ands, or buts. So let me stand with the absolute statement, which maybe isn't exactly correct, and that is it's impossible to reach absolute zero. So you can't do it. You can get arbitrary close, and we have measurements of temperatures that are like a billionth of a degree above absolute zero. So you can get very close, but you can't get colder than absolute zero. And there are good, very general arguments that stand firm on that, on those regards. Well, it's you know, it's like asking what would happen if you could go faster than the speed of light. You can't.
It's possible to go faster than the speed of light.
Correct. In a material, right? So you can have a electron that's going faster than the speed of light in glass, but you can't go faster than the speed of light in vacuum. Except in the movies.
Unless you drop into another dimension.
Yeah, except in movies, I repeat.
So, we're
you got an absolutely correct answer.
So, does anything weird happen when they get really close to that?
Lots of weird things happen as you get close to absolute zero.
Like?
Well, so, the first things that were discovered that were weird at low temperatures were superconductivity. You've all seen superconductivity?
No.
So the other neat thing that was discovered, so this is all circa 1900 when people were just starting to liquefy helium. Kamerlin Owens was the guy to do that in Holland. And the other kind of neat and surprising thing that people found was superfluidity. So superfluids can go through the tiniest holes and can climb the walls of the container that they're in and have zero viscosity, have all sorts of unusual properties. And in the last, I don't know, decade or so, Nobel Prizes were issued for these getting these extraordinarily low temperatures and making Bose condensations, you know, that are a millionth or a billionth of a degree above absolute zero.
I heard a rumor that things like start to defy gravity.
So. No defying of gravity. I mean, temperature is just a measurement of kinetic energy. So nothing. So all of these surprising phenomena happen because you get collective effects. That is to say, atoms acting together don't really act like individuals. So it's, you know, kind of like people. You know, a crowd of people can do things that an individual would never dream of doing. And it works kind of the same way for atoms. So we get lots of unusual behaviors of collective objects at low temperatures, but nothing like defying gravity.
I have a question, but it's not necessarily classroom. It's physics related. What is the slip of a fluid? I have an engineering friend and he always talks about it, and I have no idea what it is.
The slip
of a fluid. I do believe that's what it's called. Something about fluid.
Well, I mean, it sounds very similar to viscosity.
Do you know anything about it?
It's not. I can guarantee you, it's not a technical word. So he's using it either incorrectly or.
Or it's a slang term.
Yeah. I don't. I think incorrectly is the right answer. It's not a technical term. So I can show you your engineering fluid. My engineering fluid mechanics books, and that word is not in there. So there is surface friction, which incorrect is the right answer. Other questions? Okay, so, I mean, you might be discouraged, right? So on the cover of your lab manual, we've got steam engines, And here, you know, sitting in the front waiting to be used, we've got little models of steam engines. So obviously, we're going to be talking about steam engines, and why in a class that has to do with biology are we talking about steam engines? Well, the short answer is because the MCAT people say you got to know it, right? I mean, the content of this class is exactly designed to match the curriculum that they say we're supposed to teach. And I think the reason for it is that you really do need to know about thermodynamics. So C.P. Snow, kind of famously, famous dead physicist C.P. Snow, famously said that everybody, in his book Two Cultures, that was comparing humanists to scientists, said everybody should know the second law of thermodynamics, that it's fundamental about how the universe works. And it's part of human heritage the way the Mona Lisa is part of human heritage. And everyone should know about it. Say again?
What is it?
The second law of thermodynamics? We haven't reached it yet. I haven't told you. You haven't joined the human race yet. You're still with those damn humanists. So, we know. We've only talked about internal energy in our book, but we can work forward to enthalpy, which is basically just a version of internal energy, Gibbs free energy, which is famous for showing you whether reactions go or not, and entropy, which will be kind of the last topic. And these guys are all pretty similar. They're all measured in joules. Entropy is really the odd guy out, and we're going to talk about him last. So the first thing I want to dispel about heat engines is that it takes heat to make the engine. So what I've got here is liquid nitrogen, right? And this heat engine, at least in the last group, ran just fine on cold as opposed to heat. We'll see. Slowing down. It picked up speed by the end. It's not quite cold enough yet. Try it again. We'll see. So while that's going forever as a perpetual motion machine, let's take a look at the handout. So what we've got is, ooh, come on, you're supposed to go. It went all last lecture. It's tired. So what we've got on your handout is a PV curve, a plot of pressure versus volume. I'm going to spend my whole lecture just doing that, I guess. So what we've got is a material. It might be steam, it might be air. It's air in this for this particular not working heat engine. I don't think it matters which way I spin it, but we'll try it the other way. Well, it likes that way better. So the working fluid, the steam, the air, whatever it is, we're going to be interested in paths on this PV diagram. And we're going to have several named paths, and we've got, I don't know, whatever this is, 6 times 4, 24 equations for you to tattoo that correspond to the work that's done on the gas, the heat that we add to the gas, the change in internal energy of the gas, and we haven't really talked about entropy yet, but might as well make a complete table that also gives us the change in entropy. So these paths are all special, but in general, you could have any old connection of pressure and volume that you can expose the gas to. And we just have these guys that have special and commonly used relationships. So if we have a gas that starts here and it expands at constant pressure, that would be a curve kind of like that. The volume has expanded corresponding to this amount. How much work is going to be done on this sort of path? Well, let's think about putting the gas in a cylinder, and if we compress this gas, then we're doing some work, right? Because we know that the work is the force times the distance. The force we have to push with is the pressure times the area, cross-sectional area of the cylinder. And of course, if we multiply the area times delta x, we're going to exactly get this volume that we've compressed. So the work is pressure times the change in volume. Now, if we look carefully, here we've gone from a big initial volume to a small final volume, and we have done positive work. That is to say, the force and the displacement were in the same direction. So we've got a minus sign there to indicate that to do positive work on the gas, we have to compress the gas. Now, this is a kind of a problem if you go to consult another book, because probably 80% of the books do what people who design steam engines care about. So if you're building a steam engine, what you care about is how much coal do you have to buy and how much work are you going to get out. So they're not so much concerned about the work we did on the gas, but the work that the gas is going to do for us. So they are going to define W to be the work done by the gas, in which case it's going to be plus P times delta V, whereas our book defines W to be the work we did on the gas. And I hope it's clear from conservation of energy, the change in the internal energy is going to be the heat that we added to the gas plus the work we did to the gas. And that statement of conservation of energy often goes by the name of the first law of thermodynamics. Okay, so for this particular path that I drew, this isobaric path, the volume expanded, so the gas did work on us, which is to say that W has some sort of negative quantity. If we have a constant volume process, so say I, for example, put the gas in a box and I don't change the volume, but I heat it up so that the pressure increases, that's a situation where there's no change in volume, so there's correspondingly no work that's being done. So here I heated up the gas. Kind of another possibility is I could keep the gas at constant pressure, or at constant temperature, and just expand the gas. Well, we know that since PV equals nRT, if the temperature is constant, then if I increase the volume, the pressure has to go down, so I'm going to be on something like a hyperbola if I am on a path of constant temperature. So let's skip over the S constant path for a second. Another more mathematical version, which is of interest, is let's say we go in any straight line. We can calculate the work that's done because the work for every little step is the pressure times the change in volume. So the total work is going to be the area under this curve. Well, actually, it's going to be minus the area under this curve, right? Because in this particular case, the volume is expanding. So that means that the gas is doing work on us as opposed to the other way around. Okay, so if you look here, we've got exactly those sorts of entries. Constant pressure path, the work is going to be minus the pressure times the change in volume. If the volume doesn't change, there's no work. It turns out we can add up the area under a hyperbola, and this is the work that's done if we're on a constant temperature path. If the final volume is more than the initial volume, then the logarithm will be a positive number, and we'll get a negative number then for the work that's done. And we talked about this, where we're just using the usual formula for the height, for the area under, you know, one of these sorts of curves. Right? So if these are the two heights and this is the width, the area under this curve is the average of the heights times the widths. And of course, it's minus the area, so there's an overall minus sign in this equation. Okay. So for the heat that we add, well, this is a MC delta T sort of problem, right? If we change the temperature, the heat that we add is going to be MC delta T, we would have said. Now remember that I've shown you lots of times that we could use any extensive measure we wanted to, and traditionally we at least start with masses, but instead of dealing with specific heats per gram, we could deal with specific heats per mole. So this capital C is the specific heat per mole, and N is the number of moles. So it turns out that there is a certain systematic trend for these capital CPs that isn't present in the per gram Cs that we were using. And remember, we saw exactly the same thing for the elements. So the little P here is saying that this is the specific heat calculated for the pressure being constant. And that's usually how you do these sorts of experiments, right? You do them at the bench where the pressure doesn't change, it's atmospheric pressure. But you could imagine putting the material in a box and not letting the box change its volume, in which case we would have a specific heat at constant volume. If the, well, more on that in a second. Okay, so let's go back to this S constant. So P constant, T constant, V constant, lines, those are all pretty clear. We haven't talked about entropy, which is what S constant is going to mean. It means a path in which the entropy doesn't change. And a path in which the entropy doesn't change is usually called adiabatic. So we can call P constant isobaric, we can call V constant isochoric, we can call T constant isothermal. S constant is going to be called adiabatic. And what it means is that no heat is added or removed from the gas. And typically what adiabatic means is fast. That is to say, if you have, for example, the air in the cylinders of your car, when those cylinders move in a millisecond, there's no chance for heat to come or go from that cylinder. So the expansion that you get is pretty much adiabatic. If you expand a gas, I hope experience tells you, you expect the gas to cool. And if we have an adiabat on this sort of PV diagram, it's going to be a steeper curve than it is for the hyperbole that is the isothermal curve. So what exactly is the curve that describes a Q equals zero, a constant entropy, which is to say an adiabatic process? And the answer is pretty simple. The pressure times the volume to the power gamma has to be a constant. And the value of gamma is more than 1, so these things are always steeper than the corresponding PV curve, the corresponding isothermal curve.
What does gamma equal in this case?
Well, so if you look at your cheat sheet, what it says is that gamma is equal to the ratio of the specific heat at constant pressure to the specific heat at constant volume. So that seems like a hard way to do it, right? You could look up gamma or you could look up CP and CV and then divide them. But we have this final relationship that the ratio of specific heats is expected to be the integer F plus 2 divided by F. So for example, the gamma for helium is pretty much equal to 5/3. The gamma for nitrogen is pretty much equal to 7/5. So here we have F being equal to 3, and here we have F being equal to 5.
So what does the PV equals constant, like according to the graph, what is that significant for?
So this is the set of points that represents how the volume and temperature of a gas would change if you didn't add or subtract any heat.
Okay.
So if you pull out the piston of a cylinder, the gas is going to cool, and so instead of staying on an isotherm, it's going to be below it. The pressure will be less because the temperature is less at the same volume.
Okay.
So this equation plays the same role as this equation does. It tells us the set of points that that are on an adiabat as opposed to an isotherm. Okay, well, what's this magic number F? So this is called the number of degrees of freedom. And so let's back all the way up to kinetic molecular theory, where we said that the internal energy of a gas was 3/2 nRT. And that, of course, means that this would be the number of moles times the specific heat that we're talking about times the temperature. So the specific heat would be 3/2 R. So these specific heats are done at constant volume. So the specific heat at constant volume is 3/2 R for the ideal gas that we were talking about in the kinetic molecular theory. You might remember I said at the time that the internal energy of a point particle that we were talking about in that case could only be kinetic energy. So it could only have kinetic energy in the x direction, the y direction, and the z direction in three different directions. Yes?
Does C still mean specific heat, or does it mean something different now?
So that's a tricky question. So let me, instead of exactly answering that, answer a slightly different question. So you notice that these are capital C's?
Yes.
So we're going to use capital C to indicate the molar specific heat, and lowercase c to indicate the per gram specific heat.
Okay.
Is that good? Does that answer your question? So in some sense, they're all specific heats. But if it's a lowercase c, it's what we did in calorimetry, where it's all per kilogram. And for this chapter, every specific heat is going to be per mole.
Okay, so capital is per mole, right?
Capital is per mole. And of course, the capital C's look totally different from the lowercase c's when I write them on the board.
Of course.
Okay, so for these point particles in the kinetic molecular theory, all they could do is move. If we have something like a diatomic gas, it can also rotate. So there can be kinetic energy of rotation in addition to kinetic energy of. And you might remember that the formula for kinetic energy of rotation was 1/2 I omega squared. So these things could rotate this way or they could rotate that way. There are two additional ways that they can have energy. So basically, this factor of F is the number of different ways that that a molecule can have some sort of energy. It turns out if we're at high enough temperatures, the diatomic molecules can vibrate. And so F under those circumstances, instead of just being 5, translation and rotation, can be added to have new modes of energy vibration. So F would then go to 7. Yes?
So is that referring to, so U in this case is both the V and the W, because you have an arrow pointing up to U. And that refers to that half M thing, but that's added together with the I, or?
So when we talked about the kinetic, so U is the internal energy. And if we just have point particles, all they can do is move. So the only part of kinetic energy they can have is 1/2 mv squared. If we have diatomic molecules, they can rotate too, and they would be energy. So we would need to add that term to the energy. If we have vibrating rotating atoms, then they can have that energy too. So what U is all of the types of internal energy that the system has. So a lot of that energy for a chemical system where we might have, you know, a chemical reaction going on, a lot of that energy would be stored in bonds, which would be broken and reformed. So U is the total energy. In the simplest case that we could work out on the board, it was just point particles 1/2 mv squared. But in real cases, it's going to be more. And the value that it's more is parameterized in this F thing. Okay, so for monatomic gases, things that can't rotate, they're just point particles like helium and all the inert gases, for those we expect F is going to be equal to 3. For diatomic gases like N2, O2, Cl2, those can rotate in addition to vibrate, so they're going to have F equals 5. For more complicated molecules, there are more complicated modes that they can have energy, and F is going to increase. In the problems in the book, the gases are always either diatomic or they're monatomic, so F is always going to be either 3 or 5 for us. So I claim that the specific heat at constant pressure is always the specific heat at constant volume plus R. And that's what makes this ratio of specific heat at constant pressure to constant volume equal to this ratio F plus 2 divided by F. Okay, questions? So lots of new equations to tattoo. Let's take a look at the problem that goes along with this table. So what we've got is a gas that's undergoing a series of changes. And the reason I'm doing this as kind of a handout as opposed to a homework problem is this has all of them in one problem as opposed to having different processes in different problems. So follow along as we work through this problem. So what it says is we start with a gas that is monoatomic. So from that we know that F is going to equal to 3. And it's starting with 1 cubic meter at 300 Kelvin at 1 atmosphere. So the initial state is right there, right? A volume of 1 and a pressure of 1. And I don't know, let me even label that 1. And what we're going to have is a straight line process in which the volume is going to be reduced to 1/3 of a cubic meter and the pressure is going to go up to 2 atmospheres. So 2 atmospheres, this is 5, 4, 3, so someplace like there is where the second point is. And the process that we're talking about is a straight line process that connects those two points. Right? So that's the path that is being called A. For the next process, we're going to have an isobaric, a constant pressure process, where the volume is going to be returned to 1 cubic meter. So here is 2 atmospheres, here's 1. So we're talking about this process here is going to be the process that's B. We can call this third point 3. Then we're going to have an adiabatic expansion, which is going to reduce the pressure to 1 atmosphere. And these adiabatic processes, like the isothermal processes, are not going to be straight lines, so we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I don't know, let's kind of draw it like that. So that's the adiabat that is past C. We're going to reach point 4. Then it says we're going to return the temperature in an isovolume process that's going to return the temperature to 300 Kelvin. So isovolume process, this is point 5. And then we have an isothermal process that's going to return us to the original point. So this is a constant volume, right? So it should be a vertical line.
Oh.
It says a constant volume process that reduces the temperature to 300 Kelvin. And at this point, it may not be obvious whether this goes up or down. I mean, is temperature 4 above or below the original 300? We'll see that it's below. And we're going to work through all of this, but this is what detailed calculation shows for all of these processes. Okay, so
it's between 5 and 1, is that a parabola?
That's a piece of a parabola, yep. An isotherm. Okay, so let's calculate the situations at these points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we know what the pressure and volume is pretty much at these points, and so we want to get the missing term. So for point 2, we know the pressure, we know the volume. What we need to know is the temperature. And we can use the ideal gas law to give us that temperature. We know that we could write the ideal gas law directly, but usually writing it in terms of proportions is a better game. So we have P2 V2 over T2 is equal to P1 V1 over T1. We know that T1 is 300 Kelvin, and we kind of want to know what T2 is. So if we kind of rearrange this to give us T2, so T2 is going to come up, and T1 is going to come up. And what we're going to have then is P2 over P1 and V2 over V1. So we've got then 300 Kelvin. The pressure is twice the original pressure. And the ratio of volumes, V2 is 1/3 of V1. So 3 and 3 cancel, so T2 is equal to 200 Kelvin. So in this straight line process, the gas was cooled as it went to reduced pressure, increased pressure and decreased volume. Okay, so we know the pressure and volume at 3. The pressure is twice as much and the volume is the same. So we can always just add P3 V3 over T3 if we want, and we can pick anyone that we, you know, particularly care about. Let's go back to the original state. It doesn't matter. So what we have there is that T3, bring this guy up, is P3 over P1, V3 over V1, all times T1. The pressure is twice as much, the volume is exactly the same, and the original temperature was 300. So the temperature at point 3 is equal to 600 Kelvin.
Are we on little B now, part B, or part A still?
Well, so what we're doing is we're trying to figure out what the temperature is at point 3. And what it says is that we're supposed to draw out the cycle, and it's probably going to help if we know the pressure, temperature, and volume of each piece. Okay, so 4 we couldn't exactly locate because it was on that adiabatic curve. All we know is that this thing started at a pressure of 2 and a volume of 1, and we had an adiabatic expansion until the pressure was equal to 1. So if we want to calculate the volume, for example, for point 4, we have to use the adiabatic expression, that P3 V3 to the gamma, that's where we started, that has to equal P4 V4 to the gamma. And since this is a monatomic gas, we know that gamma is equal to 5/3. So if we rearrange this equation, what we have is that V4 to the gamma is equal to P3 over P4 V3 to the gamma. And I want to get rid of that gamma, right? And I can't just cancel it out. I don't think I ever said that. 5/3.
That's an H2, right?
That's an H2. That was actually an N2. This was a diatomic gas.
Oh, N2. And that's but Hg. I was going to say, because H2 isn't monatomic, but okay.
Yeah. So, oh, I see. This is He. So neon, argon, radon, krypton, all those inert gases are also monatomic.
Fantastic.
Okay, so how do I get rid of that gamma? And the answer is you take things to the 1 over gamma power. Whatever I do to one side, I can do to the other, and it'll still be an equation. So if I take so this is all inside the parentheses.
Yeah, so the gamma power on the V3 will cancel out, but won't it still go over the V3?
Well, let's see. Yep. So what we're going to have is P3 over P4 to the 1 over gamma, V3, that one got eliminated, and we've got V4. So we know that the initial volume was equal to 1 cubic meter. We know that the initial pressure was equal to 2 atmospheres, and we expanded this out until the pressure was 1 atmosphere. And 1 over gamma is 3/5. So we need 2 to the 0.6 power. And that turns out to be 1.52. So you can see I located this a little bit beyond 1.5. Well, the nasty answer is because we all took Gen Chem and we learned it there, right? All of the inert gases, all of those things on the far right-hand side of the periodic table, those are monoatomic. And I think those are at least all the monatomics that I can think of off the top of my head. So helium, neon, argon, krypton, all those noble gases, everything way over here, right? All of these guys, they changed the column labeling on me. Back in the good old days, those were Roman numerals, but now I guess it's 1 through 12? I can't remember. They changed it on me.
So then you're saying nitrogen, so then like all of those oxygen, nitrogen, they're all...
Pretty much all of these guys. So... bromine, chlorine, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen. Anyone else think of any gases? All of those are diatomic.
Okay. And that's probably all we'll have to worry about.
Yes. In fact, probably I'll say a mono. The problems I'll say a monatomic gas or a diatomic gas.
Okay. And monatomic can use 5/3,
say again? Yes. We're good to go, huh? And if you're in doubt, you can look them up in the CRC, right? They're gonna be there. Okay, so we know the volume here, and we expect that if we expanded the gas, it's gonna cool, but what exactly is the temperature at 4? Well, no. We can work it out. Could make a song like that, I guess. So we've got P1 V1 over T1 is P4 V4 over T4. So the pressure at 4 and 1 were both 1 atmosphere. The initial volume was 1. We just calculated this final volume as 5.2. So the temperature for 4 is going to be the temperature at 1, and then P4 over P1, which is 1, and V4 over V1. Yes, I believe all that. So this is 300. This ratio is 1, this ratio is 1.52. So if we multiply our volume times our temperature of 300 Kelvin, what we get is 455. So if we know that the temperature is hotter here than it is there, this had to be above there, right? More pressure corresponding to more temperature, so that's placed right. Now we're going to decrease the temp- we're going to suck heat out of this in an isovolume process to reach a temperature that is 300 Kelvin. So we know the volume, it's still the 1.52. We know the temperature is going to be 300, and what we're supposed to find is the pressure. So we know that, call that P5, I guess. We know P5 V5 over T5 has to be P1 V1 over T1. They're both supposed to be at the same temperature. We know that the volume is 1.52. The original volume was 1. The initial pressure was 1. So it must be that P5 is equal to P1, and then V1 over V5. So it's 1 divided by this 1.52. Yeah, I can use anyone. Yeah, and there's often I follow along, right? I might have used V4 for all of those, but there's no preference. They're all the same. Okay. Whatever one you know best, that's the one to use.
It's just easier. You just use the one you already figured out.
Yeah, not only that, the problem tells us exactly what all those numbers are. So if I made some sort of intermediate mistake, I won't get screwed up. Okay, so that was just figuring out what these temperatures are. The real point of the problem is to kind of fill in what all of the temperature changes, internal energy, Q, etc. are. And I'm only asking here for the signs, but you know, if we really wanted to calculate a number, all we'd have to do is plug into that table. So for this first path going from A, you remember we went from 300 Kelvin to a colder temperature, 200 Kelvin. So obviously the change in temperature is negative. The change in internal energy and temperature are pretty much the same thing for an ideal gas. So if the temperature change is positive, the change in internal energy is going to be positive. In this case, the change in temperature is negative, so the change in internal energy has to be negative. We could actually calculate if we wanted the work here, and since the change in volume is negative, the work is going to be positive, or you can just remember that the work is minus the area under this curve, and since we're going that way, we are doing work on this gas. You're not happy, Dan. If you look at it this way.
No, I'm happy. I was just making sure it was a plus sign.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a plus sign. It's a pretty fat pen.
Just making sure it wasn't a number for some
reason. And we could calculate the number if we had to.
Yes.
So why is the temperature going lower and increasing the pressure?
Basically because the volume, the pressure overexpanded the volume. If we were to find where the isothermal was here, it would be someplace like there. So it's. So Q, we could calculate Q if we really wanted to, but look, we don't have to because we've got the first law of thermodynamics. The change in internal energy is equal to Q plus W. We know the change in internal energy is negative, and we know that W is positive. So Q has to overcome that positive value. It has to be not only negative, it has to be more negative than W. No.
Not always.
If the change in internal energy is zero, then that's going to be the case. But we'll see that there's no reason they can't have the same sign. I think we'll see that. In any case, they can have the same sign. Okay, so for B, we went from 200 to 600 Kelvin. So obviously the change in temperature is positive. The change in internal energy corresponds exactly to the change in temperature. This is a Q equals MC delta T problem at constant pressure, right? So if we increase the temperature, then Q had to increase. Work is the area under that curve and minus the area under that curve. So this work is going to be negative. Or if you want, you can see that the volume change is positive, so the work is going to be negative. By definition, for the adiabat, no heat is gained or lost, so that Q better be zero. On the other hand, we know the temperature went down, right? It went from 600 to 455, and that tells us that the internal energy had to go down, and that tells us that the work has to be negative, right? Because delta E has to equal W if Q is zero by the first law of thermodynamics. For step D, we have we're going from 400 to 300, so the temperature change is negative. That means that the change in internal energy is negative. There's no change in volume, so the work has to be zero. And Q has to equal E in this circumstance, right? So Q has to be negative.
So what was the indication that the work's zero?
Because there's no change in volume. Change in volume of zero requires zero work. Nothing moved, so nothing had a chance to do any work. For the isothermal, well, there's no change in temperature because it's an isothermal, so there's no change in internal energy. We could calculate it out, but going backwards like this, where the volume is being compressed, that means that we did positive work. And since the change in internal energy is zero, that means Q has to be negative. Okay? And we did this just with signs, but, you know, it's plug and chug. In terms of the plug and chug, there's one trick that's worth noting, and that's this trick here. When we have these specific heats, they're all going to be NR delta T's with some kind of factor like F or F over 2 in front of them. And maybe we don't know the temperatures, but we can always calculate what NR delta T is by P final, V final, minus P initial, V initial.
And that F is the F equals 5 and F equals 3.
So that F is the number of degrees of freedom. 3 for a monatomic gas and 5 for a diatomic gas. Well, I could write down another equation that is a consequence of this one, namely that Cp is F plus 2 over 2 times R. I can't think of any other things that F affects. Remember what F is fundamentally, it's the number of quadratic ways you can have energy, like V squared or 1/2 kx squared, something like that. Okay, questions? Let's take a look at some of the problems in the book, which are, you know, basically just like that problem, except they don't have whatever it is as many parts as that problem had. So for this problem here, we've got a constant volume process from A to B, and we have a straight line process from B to C, and they're asking us the usual things. Oops. So I think the first question was which temperature was the coldest and at what point was it the coldest? And temperature is related to the product of P and V. So comparing A and B, it has the same volume and more pressure, so it has to have more temperature. Point C has more pressure and more volume, so the product of P and V is going to be even more. So the lowest temperature has to be occurring here on at point A. I guess I've jumped ahead to B since I couldn't see. But we might as well happily calculate the temperature at A because it's just an ideal gas calculation. So for point A, we know the pressure, we know the volume, we know the number of moles, and we can look up the gas constant. So we know that the temperature is PV over NR. pretty commonly they're giving us pressure and atmosphere just so they don't have these big numbers. But remember, we have to bring those big numbers back, right, when we run them in our calculator, because one atmosphere is 1.01 times 10 to the fifth pascals. So the pressure sure looks like it's 0.3, but let's convert it to pascals, 1.01 times 10 to the fifth. They've given us a volume in liters, which is a common unit of measuring volumes, but we want it in cubic meters. There are 1,000 liters in a cubic meter, so 2 liters is 0.002. We're supposed to divide all that by the number of moles, which is the one number they've told us perfectly clearly, and the gas constant is 8.31. So we can plug and chug. So we've got the 0.3 and the 1.01 and our exponent 5 and the 0.002 and the 0.056 and the 8.31, and I get a temperature that is 285. And of course that's going to be Kelvin. Okay, so the first part really was how much work is done, and there's no work done going from A to B, right, because there's no change in volume. But we can actually put all of those pieces together because we know that work is minus the area under that curve, and we have, you know, one of these kind of rhombuses sort of thing to find the area under, and you know it's the average of the heights times this width, which is going to give us exactly the same as the equation does. So the area, remember the work is minus the area, it's going to be the high pressure, which is 0.8, plus the low pressure, which is 0.5. The average of those two things, convert that to pascals, multiply it by the thing that's the width, which is from 8 to 2, so it's 0.006. So that'll be the area under that curve, and the work will be minus it, right? Okay, so we got 1.3 divided by 2, 1.01, and our exponent 5, 0.006, and I get 394 joules. What's the change in the internal energy of the gas? Well, the change in the internal energy is going to be given us by the formula that's in that book. Namely, it's going to be so the cheat sheet has the change in internal energy as being n times the specific heat at constant volume times the change in temperature. Oops. So this is a diatomic, this is a diatomic gas. So F is equal to 5. And in order to make that calculation, we know what the initial temperature is. We need to figure out what the final temperature is. What's the temperature here at point C? So at point C, we have a pressure that is 0.5 and a volume that is 0.008. And we're dividing by the same number of moles and our gas constant. Okay, so we got 0.5. And 1.01 and our exponent 5, 0.008, 0.0256, and 8.31. And you get a pretty high temperature that is basically 1900 Kelvin. So the change in internal energy is going to be 5 halves times the number of moles times the gas constant times the change in temperature, basically 1900, minus the initial temperature, which was 285. Okay, so 1900, 285. Times the gas constant, times 0.0256, and times 2.5. And I get 838 joules. And that let me remind you that the work was minus 394 joules. Yeah, so the work is minus the area. So we got the area, and then we inserted the minus sign.
Okay.
When we remember to do that. Which I didn't in the last class. So okay, so we've got the change in internal energy is equal to the work plus Q. They ask us what Q is. So Q is equal to the change in the internal energy minus W. We've got the internal energy as 838 minus a minus 394. We can put those things together. And I get 123 joules. So here's another problem with G steps. I'm not sure it'll be that bad. So we've got a monatomic gas this time, so that means that F is equal to 3. And the volume is always going to be 0.2 cubic meters. They give us the initial temperature and the initial pressure. And they say that we're going to add 16 kilojoules of energy. And in the end, we're supposed to find out what the temperature is. So this is really just a Q equals MC delta T sort of problem. Right? We've added 16 kilojoules. What's the change in temperature? So we do need to figure out which specific heat. Right now we got two of them, constant volume and constant pressure, but obviously we're going to use the constant volume one because they say the volume is constant. So we would be all set if we knew the number of moles, right? Because we need the amount of gas in order to do that calculation. So number of moles, PV over RT. We're told that the pressure is 5 atmospheres. Convert that to pascals. They tell us that the volume is 0.2 cubic meters. R is still 8.31, and the temperature is 300 Kelvin. So the number of moles, 5.05 and our exponent 5, 0.2 times all of that, 8.31 divided by it, 300 divide that, and I get, I don't know, 40 moles. That's a lot of gas. So the heat I'm adding is the 16,000 joules. And that wants to equal N specific heat at constant volume times the change in temperature. This is a monatomic gas, so we know that CV is F over 2 times R, where F is 3. We just have found out what N is, So the change in temperature is going to be the heat that we added, 16 times 10 to the third, divided by the number of moles times the specific heat at constant volume, 3/2 times 8.31. Okay, so I've got the 40.5 sitting at me, 1.5 times that, 8.31 times that, 16,000, divide that all in, and I get a temperature change that is basically 31.7 . If that's the change in the temperature, of course, the final temperature, we just need to add the 300 to that, so it's going to be 332 Kelvin. If we know the temperature and the volume, we could calculate the pressure. We've done that lots of times. I think we've got just enough time to do 29. So for this cycle, the work is going to be the area enclosed minus the area enclosed. And this thing is nicely a triangle, so it's very easy to calculate the area, right? It's this base, which is 2 cubic meters times this height, which is 4 atmospheres. So the work minus, because it's starting out expanding, so we have minus the 4 atmospheres times the change in volume, which we said was 2 cubic meters, area of a triangle, 1/2 the base times the height. We have extra time. 4.04 and our exponent 5. The 2's cancel, so I guess I'm done. So this is minus 4.04 times 10 to the 5th joules. Okay, so I'm kind of a normal day. There are like 2 or 3 equations to know. So now there are 4 times 6 equations to know.
Do you think we'll have to use all of those for the test, or like a majority of those?
I think you want to put exactly this. I would Xerox this and put it as the start of your cheat sheet. All of those things, yeah. You never know which one I'm going to ask you, right?
All of the A through E and the...
So just, I would, myself, I'd Xerox that. And put it on the cheat sheet just the way it is. It's in the book too, so.